Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, the programme that brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. You're welcome to contact the programme via Twitter at InsideEd, through email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you have an education story or event that you'd like to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. Later on this week's programme, we'll hear about the 50th anniversary of the Irish Mathematics Teachers Association. And we'll also hear about fundamental movement in physical education. But first we hear how one newly qualified teacher was inspired by a college project she did on students with autism. The newly qualified teacher is named Michelle Shields, and she graduated from Stranmillis University College in Belfast with a first class honours degree in religious studies and a certificate in special education. Last Wednesday, she gave a presentation to the 12th Annual Conference of the Standing Conference on Teacher Education North and South, or SCOTANS, which was held in Enniskillen. Her presentation was described to me as inspirational, so I had to meet up with her. When I met Michelle, I first asked her to tell me what her presentation at the conference was about.
My presentation was from a graduate perspective. It was about a module I took in Stranmillis, Autism and Sensory Issues, facilitated by Senior Lecturer Gillian Beck. It was also about an SEN accredited course facilitated by Dr. Noel Purdy at Stranmillis, and was basically encapsulating my journey from my ITE through my career and what personal development I'll be doing from then forward.
So can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Yes, it started in my module in year four. That was affirmation of my career choice. As I said, it was facilitated by Gillian Beck. What we did was we went through a range of issues in the autistic spectrum. So it ranged right from introduction to autism, visual strategies we can use, verbal communication difficulties, and behavioural difficulties, right down from the very top right down to the bottom. So it was a very content-rich module, and one that was very, very practical as well.
Before doing that course, did you have any experience or any knowledge of autism?
I had a year three module in SEN. That's where it basically sparked my interest. From there, I began to volunteer in a special school in the North East Education and Library Board. And in there, I just volunteered my help and was working with various classes. And that was then my first experience of SEN and PMLD, essentially. So from that, my passion and enthusiasm for it really grew. And that was why I opted to take the year four ASD module as well.
And how did what you observed in the school compare to what you had learned on your initial teacher education programme?
The parallel was absolutely fantastic. It really allowed me to bring theory into practice and to establish common links between the two. I was first sometimes sceptical of maybe the theories that I was learning, but whenever I was able to put these into practice and see these actually being used within the special school, everything came to light. And that for me then made my career choice a lot easier, and it helped me in my career as well, in my knowledge, my understanding of anything special education needs wise.
So can you describe the children or the students that you were working with who had autism?
Yes.
What were they like?
There was basically there was two pupils. This actually relates on to my dissertation work. They were non-verbal pupils, and they both had behavioural issues.
When you say non-verbal, that means they weren't talking?
They weren't talking at all. However, they were communicating through picture exchange cards, commonly known as PECs. So what I did, this is actually leading on to my dissertation in my fourth year. I worked with these pupils over a period of 10 sessions for half an hour each in a thing called a sensory room. My dissertation was trying to establish whether sensory interventions would help the communication and the behaviour of these two pupils. So it was a good dynamic between, there was one 7-year-old male and one 16-year-old female.
And you were particularly interested in their experience in the sensory room.
Yes.
Can you describe what the sensory room was like?
Well, as we know, it's a common theory that pupils with autism have sensory difficulties. So I really wanted to elaborate on that a little bit more. So what I did was I set up a sensory room. So the sensory room was essentially a room that was a simplicity of design. There was nothing in the sensory room except for a beanbag, fibre optic lights, a nice scent and nice music. And what I did was over the 10 sessions, I introduced different strategies to try and increase verbal communication, to increase choice, to increase pupil autonomy, and to try and increase focus on task and reduce anxiety.
So can you give us an example of what some of those tasks would have been?
For example, I was trying to increase communication. So for example, I would provide a choice of two toys, and one of the tasks would be to verbally say which one. For example, ball. It was commonly known then that maybe in three or four sessions that the 16-year-old girl said red ball, which was exceeded my expectations that she could use the colour red and the word ball. So that for me really said, yep, this is going to work.
And did you work one-to-one with each of them?
I worked one-to-one for half an hour in my 10 sessions. So this was solely for my dissertation purpose in year four. I worked one-to-one for that half an hour. There was a classroom assistant in the room with me as well who was observing what had happened, because as we know, two sets of eyes are better than one. So they were recording anything that I may have missed. Again, it was a fascinating experience, and one that the teachers thought was valuable, and the one that the mother of the 16-year-old child had actually said about it being incorporated in the house. The 16-year-old pupil is one that wouldn't let the mother answer a phone or wouldn't let siblings stay in the same room. It was very controlling. It was everything that she wanted. It was very control-based. But since the sensory room experiences, she had shown decreased anxiety.
And was there a progression in what you did over the 10 sessions?
Oh, totally, yes. It started off very basic, getting to know them getting to know me. You know, as we know, it's very daunting to get to know anybody as a stranger, but there was certain progressions, and each session, the results of each session then informed the sessions, the next session. So if I knew, right, I would have to go back over this again, I need to reiterate this again, or I can progress in this, or what happened in the last session, what did I do that maybe set her off or he or she off? So yes, there was definitely a clear element of progression.
So at the end of the 10 weeks then, how would you summarise what you learned or how they developed over the 10 weeks?
Well, I just want to go back then to my autism module as well. All of the theory that I learned in that through my online debate and through the case study that I was doing in there, I really brought that all to light. I brought all my knowledge and understanding from my ASD module and the sensory room experiences. It brought it all together. Again, bringing that link of theory to practice. I did learn that sensory room experiences, controlled sensory room experiences, on a routine basis can improve behaviour. That may not be the same for every child. It may improve different things, but it can work as long as it's controlled and as long as it is on a routine and stimulated basis.
So what advice would you give then to a teacher who has a student in their class with autism?
Patience. Definitely patience, a clear diagnosis as well, and clear observation. Don't give up. Don't perceive anything to be bad behaviour. Do thorough background checks. Plan effectively. Have routines. For any pupil with autism in a classroom, I would definitely say routine, and clear visual timetables. As we know, a lot of autistic learners are very visual, very strong in their visual learning. Definitely visual timetables, and any time that they have any sensory issues, I think it would be very good to even utilise Winnie Dunn's sensory profile, just to identify what sensory needs pupils have, because that could be what's all pertinent from, all deriving from, they're challenging in the classrooms. So I would definitely suggest any teacher to do that sensory file, even if it's not Dunn's as well, even if it's just observing and writing down things, that's then going to inform their decisions of what activities they can do.
And isn't her enthusiasm infectious? Thanks to Mags Amond, who suggested that I speak to Michelle Shields for the programme. Next we'll hear from Neil Hallinan, who is a retired mathematics teacher but still an active member of the Irish Mathematics Teachers Association. The association celebrated its 50th anniversary earlier this month with a Maths Fest that was held in UCD. When I met up with Neil, I first asked him to tell me how he got involved in the Irish Mathematics Teachers Association.
Well, Sean, I've been involved with the association since 1982. Now, I was a teacher for a few years at that stage, and one of the members of the association came around, visited our school and said, "You should all join the Irish Mathematics Teachers Association." So, being very dutiful, I went along to the next meeting, and I've gone along to almost every meeting since then.
And what did you get from it as a member?
Well, over the years, I suppose, it's changed, and gradually I became more involved. The first things were The main idea of that first promoter, who was a very well-known name, can I say his name, is George Humphreys, well-known to many of our listeners.
A textbook author, I think.
A textbook author.
Yeah.
Well, he started out by saying that collaboration was the name of the game and that all of us teachers could get together and help each other to learn something new, which we did. We went along to Earlsford Terrace. We used the old chalk and talk, and George led us all through various novel ideas at the time. We were quite surprised at how you could turn a very difficult concept in mathematics into the simplest, loveliest demonstration. We were so enthused. So that was the very first thing that I would say I got from the association, that communication of enthusiasm. And of course, then as years went on, I said, well, I should give a little bit back too. So it gradually grew from that and so on over the years.
And Neil, what is the purpose of the IMTA?
The purpose of the IMTA is still the same as it was on that very first time in 1964, which is to further the study and teaching of mathematics and to foster cooperation between teachers of mathematics at all levels by every means possible. And not only that, but its membership is open to all those interested in mathematics and in mathematics education, young and old, whether you're a teacher or not a teacher, which is something people forget. They imagine that it is confined to secondary school teachers or third level teachers, lecturers, and so on. But in fact, it is not. And it is lovely to see various people. In fact, at our celebratory dinner, our youngest member was age 5, and he got to shake hands with the president. And it was wonderful to see that young man, Mark is his name, and that in 50 years' time, he may well be an established mathematician celebrating with the president of that time to come in the future. And we may all look forward to that day.
To the 100th anniversary of the IMTA.
100th anniversary, because it is an organisation which is actually going strong. Our chairman, over the years, one of their briefs as well, is to form branches around the country, which they have done. Every chairperson has taken their own time, which is something which is quite a contentious issue at this moment, their own time as teachers, to go out, visit all around the country, schools and other places, and gather teachers to try and form a branch which will support the local teachers in that area. And that is really the heart and soul of what it means to be in the IMTA.
And how would you say it influenced you as a teacher?
Well, the influence was that I knew that I had something to depend upon. There was somebody else going to help sort out problems that they could be called upon, that I could go and listen to. And it brought a spirit of, I suppose, enthusiasm, as I said before, but also the kind of joy that you get from listening to ideas being presented in different ways.
And when you say, you know, that it was this kind of support for you, is that through meetings, or how does it actually do its work, the IMTA?
Well, the IMTA, I suppose, originally, when it set out now 50 years ago, it was due to a fact that there was a curriculum change. And a thing called the new maths came in, and horror of horrors, people up and down the length and breadth of Ireland, they wondered what this was, this new thing that came from possibly America, but in fact it was a worldwide event. New mathematics came through because of theoretical research and thoughts from people, quite a few of them from France, a group of Belgians and French teachers called the Boubraki, and they wrote books and said that something called sets was really important and people had to find out about them. And in 1963, some lecturers in UCD, Professor J.R. Timoney, God rest him, and Father Ingram, also gone to his reward, with others, Stephen O'Brien and Morris Kennedy, they set up a summer school to help teachers. They said, we're going to give you lectures. They gave 45 lectures, and what happened then was the teacher said, what are we going to do now? And the suggestion came about that they should form an association. Now, there already was an association in the UK, but why not form an Irish association? So they made a plan, and the following January, in the middle of their Christmas holidays, no less than 400 teachers gathered in Newman House in Stephen's Green. So it's a rather historic place. Go along there and you'll see that there were 400 teachers, all eager to find out how to join together, which they did. And they decided, not only that, they would invite President De Valera along to their next meeting to be their patron.
He had been a maths teacher, of course.
He was a maths teacher, and he was so interested in mathematics that he founded the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, which still exists today. He invited a very famous man, Schrodinger, to come and be its first professor. And following that, that was even before the Second World War, following that, in 1958, he decided to honour the greatest mathematician of the world, who happened to be Irish, of course, and not only Irish, happened to be from Dominic Street. Where else? Now, you may or may not be familiar with Sir William Rowan Hamilton. In 1843, he was walking along with his wife down by the Royal Canal, and he had a puzzle in his mind, as a lot of mathematicians do, and there he was. Perhaps his wife inspired him, as many wives do, and he suddenly got the answer to something which has stunned the world ever since. He decided to break a law of mathematics. The invention he had, of course, was a thing which he himself called quaternions. They involved four elements. And this, of course, is often related to the ideas that Einstein had about the four dimensions. And, of course, it has come about, and people had ignored it for 100 years, that it has come about that now it is involved with computers and computer animation. So it has proved incredibly useful.
And listening to you, Neil, talking about maths, and obviously it's a love for you, but there are so many children and students learning maths who actually find it difficult. So how do you bridge that gap between the love which you obviously have for the subject and the difficulty that so many learners find when they're trying to engage with it?
Well, difficulty, I think, is a cultural concept. Strangely enough, many people find maths difficult because they're told it's difficult. So one of the things is to find out, how can you convince people that maths need not be difficult? People have a thing called their mathematical identity. They believe what they can find out about maths is limited or unlimited by what they think about themselves. So in one sense, you have to convince people that they have within them an unleashed power to find out about mathematics all on their own. And this, of course, is part of the agenda of the new programme of what is now called Project Math.
And if you look back to your own mathematical learning, where was the breakthrough for you? When did you kind of say, I really get this, I really like this subject?
I know almost the day. I had my teacher, Mr. Cullen, down in Dungarvan, and he was talking to us about a subject which was called coordinate geometry. And a couple of weeks later, he began to talk to us about a subject which was called vectors. And a couple of weeks later, he talked to us about a subject called complex numbers. Now, they sound incredibly different and complicated, but strangely, he drew all the same diagrams on the blackboard. And I said, why does he draw the same diagram if they're all different things? And suddenly it came to me, they're not all different. They're all connected. So an idea that you produce in one, the very strange ideas of quaternions, can come from quite another area, which is an awful lot easier to comprehend. And that great mathematician who invented the ideas of coordinate geometry, Descartes, he took what was then a subject which could not be approached very easily, geometry, the bane of many a person's life, and he decided, well, we can actually draw this in a very simple manner. He was inspired by a spider, just like some of our ancient heroes in Ireland, Robert the Bruce, when he was over in Rathlin Island, inspired by a spider.
And that was Neil Hallinan reminding us that inspiration can come from the strangest of places. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Inside Education with Sean Delaney. Finally this evening, we hear from Dr. Deborah Tannehill, an Emeritus Faculty Member at the University of Limerick. On the 12th of November, Deborah will give a workshop in St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra, entitled The Place of Fundamental Movement Skills in the Primary Physical Education Programme. When I spoke to Deborah a short while ago, I asked her to tell me, what are fundamental movement skills in the Primary Physical Education Programme?
I guess from my perspective, fundamental movement skills really refers to young people having the knowledge, the desire, and the skills to participate in physical activity. So it's not just about moving.
And how important is it for students to have that kind of skill in school?
Oh, I think it's critical. I mean, if you look at children as they get older, like, for example, let's say a child wanted to at some point do volleyball, and a volleyball spike is the same movement as an overhand serve in tennis, which is the same movement as a hit in water polo. So in other words, there are so many similarities among activities, but kids need to learn how to do the skills before they can apply them to activities, which is the whole idea behind the skill part of fundamental movement skills.
And when you say it's not just movement, what else does it consist of?
I think from my perspective, it consists of students having the knowledge, the desire, and the skills.
Okay, so it's the full suite. And how do you categorize them then? How can a teacher get their head around the different movements that are fundamental?
I think, like, for example, if you look at, say, athletics has throwing, running, and jumping, which are skills that are in a lot of different other activities. So if we took jumping, for example, in order to jump well, if I'm jumping for height, in order to jump well, I have to get a deep crouch before I actually try to jump. So I can actually teach crouching in other activities. I could teach crouching as you're diving off a board, as a child is jumping up out of the water. They have to get into a deep crouch position. So the fundamental motor skills actually transfer from one activity to another and from one skill to another.
And how much technical knowledge is involved in either mastering the movement or teaching somebody how to master it?
From a child's perspective or a teacher's perspective?
I'm thinking more so from a teacher's perspective.
Okay. I think fundamental movement skills, there is technical pieces to it, although I don't think they are that difficult to learn. I mean, I think if you begin to think about, again, the whole idea of transfer, so a crouch is the same no matter what skill you're using. Do you see what I mean? Running form is the same whether you're playing football or you're in athletics or you're just out running.
But doesn't it still, though, make a lot of demands on a teacher? Because I would imagine that if you teach a child some movement at such an early age and they practice it over and over again during a number of years, if they're doing it wrong, it could actually do some harm.
Oh, absolutely. Not only do some harm, but, like, for example, you can look at young people. I have kids that come to the university that don't know how to run properly because we always assume kids just start running and they know how to run. But I'll see young people that actually don't lift their knees. They run with pushing their feet forward. They don't use their arms, or they cross their arms across their body. That's never been corrected. So, yes, it does take knowledge of teachers to be able to do that.
And how can a teacher put together a program then that is interesting enough for the students, given that some students, all they want to do is to play team sports. So how can they put together a program that is going to actually be inspiring and interesting for the students?
I think, first of all, there is a program that's put together for teachers that, you know, we have it actually on the website, the PSSI website, has a primary school sports initiative that has lesson plans, and it actually has a great sequence of activities across a number of different strands to help teachers. What was the other part of your question? Sorry.
Well, I suppose I'm just wondering, how can it be comprehensive enough that it will actually be motivating for the students?
I see. Yep, gotcha. I think part of it is that children need to understand first the relevance and the context. And so teachers need to teach motor skills, but then let students apply them. In other words, as we begin to teach motor skills, put students into an application activity, not necessarily the parent game that they're ultimately going to be in, but modified type games that students can begin to be successful in so that they begin to achieve mastery as they move along.
And how consistent is the program that you have devised with the content of the primary school physical education curriculum?
Well, I'm not the one that devised it, first of all. The support services are actually the ones that devised it, and it is quite comprehensive. I believe it's built on some of the work done by Graham, Holthale, and Parker in children moving, and it's a very progressive system that really does break fundamental motor skills down, but applies them to appropriate physical activities for kids' age levels.
That's what I was going to ask you as well, about the age levels. How does the range of fundamental movement skills vary from age to age throughout primary school?
I don't know whether, and I actually probably shouldn't have said age, because it's not necessarily age specific. In other words, you're going to have some children that are in third class that are more skilled than some that are in fourth class. And so it really does depend on the child. And so teachers have to be able to look at the lesson plans and be able to adapt them for the ability of the children that they have.
And would weights ever be part of what they would do as part of a movement program?
Would what? Weights?
Weights, yeah.
No, because that is not a fundamental movement skill. That is an applied skill, and it is a fitness skill that they eventually will learn. But I wouldn't see them doing that early in primary schools, no.
Okay, so you're actually being quite specific in terms of this is about movement.
It's about movement,
And the knowledge and the skills and the disposition towards it.
Exactly. I mean, you have to make it enjoyable for kids or they're not going to want to participate.
Yeah,
children moving and being active frequently is part of it. But they have to have that desire. So you're absolutely right. They have to have something that's designed where they learn skills, but they apply them so they do enjoy the activity.
And is nutrition or diet a part of what would come under this at all?
No, it certainly is equally as important, but it's not part of the fundamental movement skill complex, no.
And the reason I'm speaking to you is because you're giving a workshop on the topic in early November, on the 12th of November.
I am indeed at St. Pat's, and it's actually going to be a presentation and an applied workshop. So the presentation will really be very short in terms of it's for teachers, practicing primary teachers and pre-service teachers that are learning to teach primary school, as well as primary teacher educators. And it'll be a presentation and an applied workshop so that they get a chance to have discussion about fundamental motor skills. And then I'll be using these primary school sports initiative lesson plans to show them how they can apply fundamental motor skills within those lesson plans.
And they will be allowed to move themselves?
Yes, exactly.
And Deborah's workshop is on the 12th of November in St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra. Well, that's all we have time for on this evening's programme. I'd like to thank my guests, Michelle Shields, Deborah Tannehill and Neil Hallinan. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to almost 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening. Thank you.